Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, has the Gordie Howe Bridge between Detroit and Windsor gotten behind schedule? Stateside's Lester Graham puts that question to the governor's point man on the project.
Every time I hear about delays, I just say there are no delays. We had to work really hard to get that RFP out.
And the story of a Jewish family who fled Nazi Austria to settle in Traverse City. But first, early this year, Governor Snyder sent shockwaves through the state's mental health care community when his proposed 2017 budget included changes in who would control the purse strings. The governor proposed taking much of the $2.4 billion mental health care system and switching that from public mental health organizations to private HMOs. A work group made up of state officials, mental health advocates, insurance industry representatives, state mental health providers, and others was formed to explore this issue. Last week, the group released a draft report that, in essence, sees the state reversing its course on shifting mental health funding, at least for now. With us is Kevin Fisher. He's executive director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Michigan. Kevin, the report that just came out is part one of two. It has 69 policy recommendations. What are the highlights for you? What's in there that you felt strongly had to be there?
Well, the highlights for us is really protecting the rights of consumers and caregivers to make sure we maintain some sense of continuity of care, that we maintain the person-centered planning and other aspects that we don't think the traditional HMO or medical model would recognize and know how to implement.
What about surprises? What was in there that if you and I were talking back at the beginning of this year when that proposed governor's budget came out, you would have been stunned that this made it into the set of recommendations?
You know, honestly, what surprises me most is that we've made it to this point and that we were able to come together and create this policy, you know, the 69 recommendations for the legislature to move forward. Because if you recall, when this bombshell dropped, many people assumed it was a foregone conclusion that the governor's recommendation was just going to happen and we wouldn't have a voice and the citizens' voices wouldn't be heard and we'd have no recourse. So the big surprise to me is that we've made it this far. I am always cautiously optimistic as we move forward that we will develop an alternative plan that will meet the needs of the people we serve.
Now, Kevin, you and other mental health advocates were ready to walk away from the work group earlier this year. Remind us why.
Well, you know, the concern was that the department wasn't negotiating in good faith. At the end of the day, it sounds a little harsh, but that's what our concern was, that we were not going to adhere to the principles of the original 298 work group, which you recall consisted of almost 130 people. And we met five times and we put a lot of work and sweat into that. And the message we were receiving from the department at the time was that all that work was for naught and that we were going to abandon those principles and move forward as if they didn't exist. And that's what we were willing to walk away from, because we have a responsibility to the citizens of Michigan, those who receive mental health, developmental and intellectual disabilities, those people who receive services, and even those who don't.
Now, when you say department, of course, you're talking about the Department of Health and Human Services. What changed?
Yes. Well, you know, first of all, I have to give a lot of credit to Lieutenant Governor Calley, because he immediately stepped in and assured us that those principles would be adhered to. The second thing that I have to do is honestly give credit to the people from the Department of Health and Human Services, because they listened. And I think one of the other big surprises that many Michigan citizens will get from this is that the Department of Health and Human Services leadership truly listened to what we feel is in the best interest of our citizens and the people we serve. And the temperature in the room really changed from that point moving forward.
Now, Kevin, there was, as we've alluded to, so much concern. You called that a bombshell. among consumers of state mental health services and their families and service providers and advocacy groups just like yours that the mental health care system in our state could fall into the hands of private for-profit HMOs. How do you feel now?
I'm cautiously optimistic that we will have some protections, and I'm still concerned because I'm just one of those people who doesn't believe it's over until it's over. You know, the old Yogi Berra saying, and I think we still have some work to do. And really, even though producing and agreeing upon these 69 policy recommendations, this is really just the beginning of the work, and it was hard. The next steps, when we're putting together and examining proposals, considering pilot programs, what service will look like going forward, that's really going to be the hard part, and that's really where the rubber's going to meet the road and determine if our voices have truly been heard and if we can deliver a system of care that's better than what we have but does not turn the system over to the HMOs. Because, again, quite frankly, today as we sit here, I don't think they're ready for it. I don't think they understand all of the nuances that go into building better lives for people who live with mental health, intellectual, developmental disabilities.
And is that the part two of the report that will be coming out next year? Is that what we're going to see, the idea of pilot programs and new ideas?
Yes, that's the part two that we are going to begin in January, accepting proposals and developing those pilots. And that part of the work plan is scheduled to be delivered to the legislature by March 15th now.
There was a lot of talk, and you and I have certainly spoken about this effort over the past year. And one of the things you and others have said is there could be more streamlining and consolidation in the system to make it more efficient. Where are you on that front?
I still believe that holds true. And, you know, I think that's one of the challenges that the private inpatient health plan managers and the community mental health executive directors across the state really have to take a look at. You know, I've had an opportunity to talk to Director Nick Lyon, who's the director, of course, over at the Department of Health and Human Services. And one of his concerns, and the reason he tells us that 298 was presented the way it was, is because the Department of Health, and let's just say the administration, was looking for the current system as we know it to always look to better itself, to reinvent itself. And we truly believe, and I would agree with him, and I think my fellow advocates do as well, that there is some opportunity to eliminate some of the administrative overhead and make the system run better and be able to reinvest some of those dollars back into the system of care. And the challenge is going to be for the people who are part of the current system to explore and deliver that and not just assume that since we've gotten this far in this process that the status quo is going to be okay, because I don't think that's going to get the job done.
So that's the work that awaits you in the new year.
Yes.
And these are recommendations, these 69 recommendations in this first report. How likely do you think that they will proceed on the road and actually become policy?
Again, being the cautious optimist that I am, I really believe that most of, if not all of the recommendations will move forward. A lot of work, a lot of thought went into this process. You know, as I read the report, it was pointed out that we've held 44 meetings. That sounds like a lot, but when you consider the conference calls and the emails and everything that's transpired, a lot of really hard work, sweat, and tears has gone into these proposals, and I'm really proud of the fact that all of the people at the table, be it the advocates, the representatives from the Department of Health and Human Services, the administration, even the folks that represent the healthcare organizations, we all had to come together to create this document. And I'm very proud that we were able to do that because the temperature in the room was pretty tough sometimes. But when we got down to voting about 2 weeks ago, it was actually a lot easier than I anticipated because we had done the groundwork.
Lots of lessons to learn, isn't there?
It is. You know, I've had people call me, even people who are in the current system, and they've called and congratulated me, and they said, we won, and we haven't won anything. This is just phase one. Phase two and three is going to be hard.
And we'll be watching and talking with you as that proceeds as we get into 2017. Kevin Fisher, Executive Director of the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Michigan. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
For some, this is not the most wonderful time of the year.
Those of us who do not have those families around us or have recently suffered a loss or have recently been through a breakup, you feel more lonely, you feel more isolated.
Beating the Holiday Blues. That story is next here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Type the words holiday depression into Google search and you'll get nearly a million hits. It's tough enough when you're feeling down and out of step with everybody else. But it's even tougher now during the holidays with the messages of cheer, those tidings of comfort and joy. Let's talk about navigating this overly festive season of the year if you or someone you care about is struggling with depression. We welcome Michigan State University psychiatrist Dr. Farha Abbasi. Doctor, is it fair to say for a lot of people this is not the most wonderful time of the year? In fact, it's pretty darn miserable.
Definitely. So we have often struggled with the myth of holiday blues. Mental health providers feel that the number of patients they are seeing does increase. But I think it is basically those who are vulnerable. This is much more heightened time of stress for them. They are more vulnerable to feeling lonely, isolated, more depressed, and more prone to act out on their suicidal thoughts.
I'm wondering, Dr. Abbasi, what's going on here? I mean, I think about a lot of family time or not enough or grieving. What kind of things contribute to this extra feeling of feeling sad and depressed?
Cindy, this is the time when the families come together. This is a time of social connection. You are meeting friends, even the people you haven't seen in years come together, or families are traveling from far off to be together to celebrate. Those of us who do not have those families around us or have recently suffered a loss or have recently been through a breakup, you feel more lonely, you feel more isolated. But then there are people who are going through severe financial crisis right now. And the holidays have become such a time for consumerism, like the gifts you buy. And I'm always talking about the gifts should not only be a thing, it can be valuable that you give away in the name of your loved ones. So giving to charities or giving the gift of time. So there can be so many things that can be done differently to be more inclusive and thoughtful of those who do not have what some of us are privileged to have.
Dr. Abbasi, what advice do you give when people express that feeling of depression or really a bad case of the holiday blues? What are some steps to deal with that?
I encourage them to keep their connections, find friends, or even if you do not have anyone around in the area, at least connect to some other support groups, find church, faith groups, or places that you can volunteer. Even some charities have holiday dinners, events happening, so participate in that and feel connected. But do not sit alone with these feelings, with these thoughts. It's very important to connect to others.
And keeping healthy, just moving your body or watching what you're eating.
Absolutely.
Or working out can help.
I think that's the advice I give to everyone, is to be very conscious. Do not go overboard with eating, drinking, any kind of like sleep deprivation. So it's very important to keep to the normal healthy routines and to find moderation in everything we are doing. And also it's very important to have your own time because you are so crowded all the time that sometimes that can be overwhelming. Take maybe 5-10 minutes where you can go out for a walk or you can read a book or you can just sit in quiet.
And then finally, just for family and friends who are watching someone they care about struggling this way, what's some advice?
If you are aware of someone being depressed or who has engaged in self-harming behaviors previously, it's important to keep them engaged, keep them involved in whatever activities are going on. But any sudden changes of behavior, it's not only that some people will show you being very depressed, some will appear more happier than usual, calmer than usual. And we would think like, oh, they are doing better. But that in itself can be a red flag that they have taken a decision to hurt themselves and that's why they are feeling calm. Any excessive drinking, any kind of excessive behavior, all those are very important things to look out for. For those who are feeling depressed and are feeling lonely, I think it's very important that they too connect with the professional help as well.
Well, I certainly hope that people can get through this in the ways you suggested. And I gotta bet some of this is seasonal affective disorder. So if we can just get through that and look forward to spring and sunshine, I think that will help lift some moods.
Absolutely. And there's no better sunshine than love and having those connections around you.
Dr. Farha Abbasi, Michigan State University psychiatrist. Many thanks, Dr. Abbasi.
Thank you. I would just quickly like to give the number out for National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. If you are feeling overwhelmed or are finding it difficult to cope, please do call the number 1-800-273-8255 or contact your provider. Thank you.
A new publicly owned international bridge crossing has been in the works since the Granholm administration. Governor Snyder signed a deal with the Canadian government in 2012. The bridge was named after hockey great Gordie Howe in 2015. Yet, if you were driving along I-75 near the Detroit River recently, it may seem as though nothing is getting done. Stateside's Lester Graham spoke with Michigan's point person on the project to see just where things stand as 2017 fast approaches.
Recently, there was a story in the Windsor Star about delays to the new bridge project between Detroit and Windsor. We had the author on, Ann Jarvis. She was reporting that the Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority has more or less gone from getting the Gordie Howe Bridge built to explain why it's not being built at the moment. On the Michigan side, Andy Doctoroff is a special projects advisor to Governor Snyder, and he's the point person on the Gordie Howe International Bridge, and he joins us now. Thanks for coming in.
Hey, it's my pleasure.
What does Michigan have to do to get the bridge construction underway? Where are you at in the process?
Well, Michigan has a fairly defined role. We are partners in this project, but that partnership is defined by the underlying crossing agreement that was executed by the government of Canada and Michigan. That gives us very specific responsibilities, obviously land acquisition for the properties located in the footprint here in Michigan, as well as making sure that we're providing appropriate consultation and advice to guarantee compliance with applicable regulations that will entitle Michigan to receive $2.2 billion in federal transportation matching funds. Because of those two specific issues, as well as the fact that the bridge obviously is landing here, there's going to be a state-of-the-art customs facility, we are partners. That said, the WDBA is the Canadian entity that is managing the day-to-day project.
Yeah. Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority.
Yes.
Right.
And there is also international authority that oversees certain aspects of the project, and Michigan has three appointees to that.
Okay, so let's talk about land acquisition.
Sure.
Is that on target? Is that on pace? What's the progress on making sure that you actually own the land that will be the footprint for this bridge?
There is a common misperception that the project can't go forward unless and until we get all of the parcels acquired nice and neatly. And that's not the case. What we have for the project is a staged construction schedule, and we need specific properties by specific dates. So when I say we're on schedule, we're confident that given how our team is operating and it's fully functional, doing what it should be, and there are a lot of team members, that we will have the properties we need by the time we need them.
Does the Maroon family or Maroon Holdings, one of their companies, the people who own the Ambassador Bridge, which is really opposed to the Gordie Howe Bridge, do they own any of the parcels that you need to buy?
Yes.
How many?
There are certainly more than a dozen properties that are owned by Detroit International Bridge Company or its affiliates. But there is one major property, which is referred to as Yellow Trucking, that must be addressed. I don't talk about specific parcels of property because, well, there are a lot of reasons why
I shouldn't be doing it. This is a unique case, though.
Yeah. But I can say that the Maroons, DIBC, are treated like any other landowner. We are following the same process that we follow for every single property owner, and we have the same protocols and legal remedies, if necessary, that are available to us for, again, all property owners, including DIBC.
The city of Detroit has not yet granted easements to the state that you're going to need, street easements and things like that. What's the delay on that? I would think that would be a quick signature, and here we go.
I'm not going to agree that there's a delay, respectfully.
All right.
I think that Detroit is a partner in this project, and we are having very good conversations with Detroit to make sure that all stakeholder concerns are addressed.
Are they using that as a leverage to get, for instance, they're wanting to get community benefits for the neighborhood that's involved in this? Is that a leverage piece?
I'm not going to really characterize our discussions because they're confidential. What I can say is we're very comfortable with our relationship with Detroit. Everyone is committed to making sure that all stakeholder interests are protected, including the community. The community is extremely important, obviously, to Detroiters, but also to the governor and his administration and MDOT. And we are working very closely, not just with the administration, but also with many community groups, including the community advisory group and local representatives, to make sure that we understand their concerns, that their concerns are being appropriately addressed, that there are no adverse impacts, and to the extent that there are any adverse impacts, that those impacts are fully mitigated.
I do know that they've been asking, the community group you're referencing, has been asking for larger setbacks than were in the original plan. Is that something that's under consideration?
You got to be careful how you characterize what the requests are. It is fair to say that the community wants to make sure that the bridge footprint and the activity in the footprint doesn't adversely impact those closest to the project who will reside outside the footprint. And what we are doing consistently is having conversations to make sure everyone has a shared set of assumptions. And I'm confident that when we do have a shared set of assumptions, the issues will be addressed appropriately.
The Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority has had some personnel changes lately. Has that had any impact on progress toward getting the bridge built?
Yeah, I've read about that. I've read about that concern, and that was a curious bit of reporting. The fact of the matter is the WDBA is fully operational. It's a great partner. Obviously, every single organization, whether it's a radio station, whether it's a law firm, whether it's a governmental entity, has some attrition. I have not noticed any type of attrition or turnover that would suggest that there are problems with the functionality of the WDBA. And that, you know, narrative, I think, is not correct.
The other thing that's happened in the process of this change of government in Canada, the Stephen Harper government is out, Justin Trudeau is in. Harper was really backing the project. He really wanted this bridge. Do you have the same kind of support from the Trudeau government?
Absolutely. That's another kind of media narrative or just narrative that's out there that you hear that is, I think, unfortunate. The Canadian government has recommitted again and again to this project. It is funding this project. It is paying all the bills. It is aggressively engaged. And the most obvious example of that, and I think you're aware of it, Lester, is that recently we got out a several thousand page RFP and related documents that clearly reflect Canadian commitment to this project. It was a major project milestone. And every time I hear about delays, I just say there are no delays. We had to work really hard to get that RFP out. It was an extensively discussed document. It's out, and it speaks for itself.
The Maroon family, which, as I mentioned earlier, owns the Ambassador Bridge, they've been cutting land deals with the city of Detroit. They've been hiring lobbyists in Canada. They're still working toward a twin span to go alongside the Ambassador Bridge. which the Maroons say will make the Gordie Howe Bridge unnecessary. How might that affect the progress on the Gordie Howe Bridge, that they're still pursuing that idea and now lobbying in Ottawa?
Well, I think we have to be careful about what assumptions we're making about what they're actually asking for and what they're specifically asking for in writing. There is a big difference between, of course, a replacement span and a twin span. Everyone agrees that we need two fully operational bridges crossing this border. The assumption of this project is that there will be two bridges. There is no reason at this point I'm aware of for that assumption to be believed to be incorrect.
I'm not sure what you mean by twin span or accompanying span. Why don't you clear that up for me, because I'm not following you.
Sure. The Maroons have a bridge. It's the Ambassador Bridge. It is hoped that there, and it's expected that there will be a bridge near that location. And we fully expect that's what the result will be, that there will be a bridge, whether it's an Ambassador Bridge or a new replacement span. And in, you know, documents, obviously, that have been filed that I have seen, I am not aware of any suggestion that they are asking the Canadian government for a twin span as opposed to a replacement span.
Ah, I get your point now. Okay, so bottom line it for us, is progress on both sides of the border on the Gordie Howe International Bridge on schedule, or have there been delays, as have been mentioned? I mean, are we going to get that thing built by the time everybody thought we were?
Well, there was a date of 2020 that people had bandied about and that had been stated by certain officials. The fact of the matter is that that 2020 date is probably at this point unrealistic. That said, I always quarrel with the word delay, because there has never been a delay. There has never been a stoppage. There has always been inexorable progress. And we are continuing to make inexorable progress. And when you think about the complexity of this project, it is not simply laying down a pontoon bridge. It is an extraordinarily multifaceted project with an I-75 interchange, with two customs plaza, with a very, very long bridge spanning the Detroit River. We are dealing with many agencies, many governments at many different levels. And when you take a look at all of the factors that have to work together, I believe that the progress, taking all those factors into account, is really great. And I'm very proud of it. And I'm very confident that we will get this bridge done, and we will get this bridge done without there being any real interruption in the work at all.
In what year?
The math is as follows. We just got out the RFP. We expect that within a year we will have the proposals from the three teams of bidders who are vying to become the concessionaire. We expect that within 6 months after that, we will have selected and signed the concessionaire, so that project company will be identified. And then we expect at this time that it will take approximately 4 years, could be more, could be less, for the construction to be completed and the whole facility to be open. So that's the timeline that we're currently working with. Nothing is etched in stone. The key issue is not when is it going to be done, in my mind. The key issue is progress continuing at a healthy speed? And if it is, we're going to be happy. That said, we want to get this done as soon as possible, and everyone's busting gaskets to make sure that happens. So I'm confident that according to that timeline, we will have a new beautiful span framing the Detroit skyline that is going to completely energize the economy in Michigan, in the region, that will add thousands of jobs, and that will allow us to say once again that we're capable of doing together great things, because this bridge is going to be a great tribute and hallmark of this region.
Now, if I followed your timeline, it sounds like you're talking about late 21, early 22.
I'm not going to quarrel with that.
Right. Okay. That's Andy Doctoroff. He's special projects advisor to Governor Rick Snyder. We've been talking about the Gordie Howe International Bridge and the progress on that. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure being here.
Still to come, the family that fled Nazi Austria to build a new life in Michigan, and what happened to the loved ones they left behind. The Holocaust comes to life in letters cherished by a Traverse City family. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 75 years ago this month, the United States entered the war in Europe. This next story is about the dramatic impact that declaration of war had on a Jewish family from Austria during the Holocaust. Some of the family members escaped and settled in Traverse City. Morgan Springer from Interlochen Public Radio has their story.
Lil Ostendorf sits in her home in Traverse City. In front of Lil is a copy of a letter written by her grandmother. It was written in 1943 when Lil was 3 years old.
All right. Are you going to preface this in any way, or do I just start? Do you want me to read this, the date and everything, right?
Lil's grandmother wrote the letter in diary form. The letter begins in 1941 as she flees Austria to escape the Nazis during the Holocaust and follows her journey over the next 2 years.
Budapest, May 27th, 1943. My beloved dear children, my heart will not give up hope that we shall see each other again in happiness. However, in the event that cruel fate might not permit us to come to you, I am writing this all down as far as I can remember so that you at least might know everything from the time we were no longer able to write to you.
This story spans two continents and three generations.
I'm Robert Adler, or Bob. I don't have any preference.
My name is Lil. My last name is Ostendorf. My maiden name is Adler.
I'm the youngest of three.
Of course, I'm the smartest one. Just ask them.
Bob is visiting his sister Lil at home in the house where they both grew up. Lil raised three kids and has multiple grandkids.
I keep coming back to family, but it's the most important thing, and it's, if I were to die tomorrow, it would be the most important thing I've ever done.
Bob lives downstate with his wife, where he ran a restaurant business before retiring. Lil takes down an old family photo album.
Wait a minute, there's one in here in particular. That is my mother.
There are other photos of her grandparents' restaurant in Vienna, and of her father sitting at the beach in Traverse City. Lil and Bob's parents left Vienna in 1939. The Nazis had taken control of the city the year before. At the time, they only had one child, Lil and Bob's brother Steve. They left their parents and siblings behind, and Lil says it was one of the hardest moments in her mother's life.
It was heartbreaking. You know, she left her family. She couldn't do anything. She had to get out. She had no choice.
Their mother's name was Ilse. Their father was Henry. They arrived in Traverse City after they were sponsored by Congregation Beth El. Shortly after that, Lil and Bob's aunt got out of Vienna and joined them. Like their mother, their aunt, Susie, had left her parents behind. She explained that in an interview with Interlochen Public Radio almost 40 years ago.
It left me with a burden of guilt because all of a sudden I realized that I left them. They stood there and I left them.
Vienna, 1941. Purely on the surface at that time, nothing has changed for us. We still had our fixed income, in contrast to the unfortunates who had to exist from the breadlines and donations. But inside, we were just as finished as all the others. As long as there was left even a glimmer of hope to yet get out, one was able to hang on. But with the declaration of war, when all hope was lost to get to you, we were completely broken. All around us in despair, the many suicides. In this time, the poor wretches, Uncle Jacob, Gisa, and Alice, jointly committed suicide.
Back in Traverse City, the family was doing everything they could to get Lil and Bob's grandparents out of Vienna. That meant getting the proper immigration paperwork, visas, sponsors, permission to leave the country. And they succeeded. But then they needed money to pay for their passage to the U.S.
Without that money, there was no chance of getting them out of Europe.
It cost about $300 per person. The family in Traverse City was struggling to make ends meet, so they had to ask other Jewish people in Traverse City for the money.
most of the Jewish people at that point were, for lack of a better term, town burghers. They were in business. They owned their own homes. They had automobiles, and they had icebox or refrigerators full of food.
But Bob and Lil say it was hard work convincing them.
They really couldn't imagine that these people were going to go to their death if they didn't have this little bit of money.
So wait a second. There were all these people here who had money, and they didn't get it.
No, they didn't get it from anywhere.
Then their parents and aunt turned to Jewish organizations in the U.S.
And letter after letter went to different organizations appealing for the money.
But they were turned down again.
March 27th, 1942. Everything had to be done in complete secrecy. Not even our tenants must get an inkling of our plans. Finally, the day arrived when Joe Sabosky came to pick us up. At 6 p.m., we left our flat. Now with the streetcar still with the yellow star on our persons, up to the subway, where in the station restroom we hastily ripped off the yellow stars.
2 years after Lil and Bob's parents came to Traverse City, in 1941, in the midst of World War II, the U.S. and Germany declared war. And when that happened, their grandparents could no longer legally leave Vienna and come to the United States. No amount of immigration paperwork or money would help.
At that point, our father had enough of the Jews.
Specifically Jewish people in Traverse City.
He literally said that he didn't think he could ever forgive the Jews for not being able to help or not wanting to help or trying to help. That is such a difference in his personality, because he was a gentle, forgiving, intelligent person. It was drizzly, clouded over, and windy. The way was across wet fields, still soggy from snow. Our guide very nervously constantly drove us, Papa with a heavy knapsack, me with a briefcase in my purse. The anxiety, the darkness, and the horrible road, it was frightful. Suddenly I got stuck in the mud with one foot and could not go on. Joe Sabosky swore and threatened to leave us behind.
World War II ended in 1945, but there was no word from Lil and Bob's grandparents. The family in Traverse City suspected they were dead.
Finally, with everybody's help, I was able to free my foot, but the shoe stuck. By the time I was finally ready to continue, you can imagine how it was to run on with wet, muddy shoe. Then came a long stretch along the slanting train trestle, always chased, always sinking into the wet snow. And so it went for over 2 hours.
When Lil and Bob were growing up, they really didn't know anything about their grandparents and this story. They described their life in Traverse City as idyllic.
We didn't know any of this history when we were younger. What I mean is mom and dad did not sit us down and say, this is what happened to us. But you know something happened. We were still not at the border and had to hurry. But finally there we were out of the woods. Here now was the broad ribbon of a highway and across, finally, Hungary. We gazed across as if it were the promised land. Now we had to be twice as careful. This was the most dangerous spot. The moon was out, and therefore that much greater danger to be discovered and perhaps get shot from both sides. Thus we had to run, one at a time, quite bent over, across the clearing as fast as we could. Joe Sabosky went first, then I, and then finally Papa, and at last we were across.
When Lil was 13 years old, she found a pamphlet. She showed it to her brothers.
It was called Never Again, and it's in three different languages. and it's actual photographs, not the photographs that you've all seen of piles of bodies. It's not that. These were photographs of actual events of torture, where they, for example, put a Jew on a seat in a circular pool to see how long it would take this person to freeze to death, and turned it.
What did you, how did you feel when you saw it?
I was devastated, because I knew I was a Jew, and I knew that we were Jews, and at that point in my life, I knew that we didn't come from Traverse City originally.
When it hits you when you're 12 years old that you could be walking down the street and somebody wants to kill you, who doesn't even know you, and has no reason to want to kill you other than the fact that you're a Jew or you're an Indian or you're black or fill in the blank. I mean, there's enough hatred to go around towards just about any ethnic group. And that more than hurt me, it bewildered me. I said, well, why the hell would anybody want to do that?
Budapest, spring 1942. Eventually, we found a furnished room, but because we could not register by ourselves, we got into the wrong hands. It cost our last money to get some papers, which actually only a regular citizen was permitted to carry. In the end, we had a very nice room with kitchen and bathroom to share, and even a balcony available. But then fate caught up with us. The man who had gotten us our papers was arrested and gave our names, and thus we were arrested on Whitsuntide, Sunday of 1942.
On that Sunday, in 1942, Lil's grandparents were sent to a Hungarian prison. There, her grandmother began writing this letter that Lil's been reading. Her grandmother's name was Bella Goetz.
What's in this letter is the last communication that my mother and my aunt had with their parents.
How did the letter get to Traverse City?
It was found after the war by a cousin.
It was found when their cousin returned home. The house had been ransacked, and the only thing left was this old table, and in its drawer was the letter. It was written on toilet paper. The letter was mailed to Lil's mother and aunt in Traverse City in 1948.
Budapest, May 27th. 1943. It has now been over a year that we have been in prison, where I am now writing this. What we have gone through here and how we are able to bear it all is not so easy to describe, especially when Papa was taken elsewhere. I lost all composure and thought my heart would break. We've not specifically been able to find out where our grandparents died. We were pretty sure from some of the paperwork that we have that they were supposedly on the last train out to Auschwitz from Budapest.
Behind Lil, on the wall of her home office in Traverse City, hang pictures of her maternal and paternal grandparents.
There were 39 living siblings of those people that you see here when the war started, when the Nazis started to murder people. Of those 39, they were all married, all but one, and they had children. Now, those people are gone. I'm never going to know those people. I'm never going to know my grandparents. I don't think that you can truly ever understand what it feels like to know that there were all these people that I really would have loved to have known. I would have liked to, but I don't think there's any way that you could understand it. I never cursed anybody, but then when I was so completely separated from all those I loved and found myself in prison, I did curse all, especially those who could have helped us so easily to be there with you and did not do it. May God reckon with them. He will. And he did. All the bitter tears that we cry from our aching hearts. So far from you, our beloved ones, may they sear their hearts, and you too must never, never forgive them.
Of course, I lost my parents, so this is a personal pain. But don't you believe that, for every Jew that was killed, that every Jew who has survived is hurting?
That's their aunt, Susie, again, talking to Chris Dixon at Interlochen Public Radio in 1978.
I feel that the whole world is guilty. The Germans perpetrated the things physically, but the rest of the world still died.
Their aunt says for all the people who did help Jewish people, many did not. It was easier and safer to denounce them.
The fear of self-preservation is the strongest instinct. I mean, if you have a choice of one of us is going to get killed, what are you going to do?
Well, what do you think this means about mankind? To me, it means that the potential darkness of a human being
is there.
Is incredible.
But it is there. In the given circumstances, most people are capable of doing most things.
For Lil, this is why it's important that her family's story live on.
The genocide that has this world has seen over the years, you know, Armenia and Botswana, and now with the Syrians, and in our own political dynamic in this country, we're seeing people actually talking about a whole race of people in a negative way. Have we not learned anything? But I think that that's important that you learn as a survivor of such an atrocity to let people know that you've survived, that your parents survived, and survived in a way where we can pass this on. And hopefully one of these days we're all going to listen to that instead of letting this happen over and over again. Dear Papa looks relatively good, and I myself look good too, but we have aged a lot. We have become very old. My hair is quite gray, and my eyes have suffered a lot. In spirit, I am with you always, and with your darlings, and by imagining them, I can bear life without you. If we only could have gotten any news from you. May God grant you a happy life and freedom. My beloved children, I shall pray for you. For your happiness in your life, I kiss and embrace you, your Muti. I'm done.
That story was produced by Morgan Springer and edited by Peter Payette. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Allie Billings, Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Lindsay Scullin, and Josh Hakala. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.